Ladies and gentlemen,
the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. For I have complete confidence in the response and dedication of our citizens whenever they are fully informed. I not only could not stifle controversy among your readers, I welcome it. This administration intends to be candid about its errors. For as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news, for it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
Welcome to Art House Radio. This is episode 43. I am your host, Troy Ramos. You know, I don't think I say that enough. I think I probably should say that more. But I think you know that, right? So the beginning of this episode, you were listening to a speech by John F. Kennedy, JFK, and the clip, the particular clip on YouTube listed as the speech that got him killed, which I thought would be a delightful and energizing, bright way to start this episode. Now, I know you're thinking sometimes, why do they get into politics here? Well, listen, you can't separate politics from anything, right? It's involved in everything, especially the arts. People in the arts are nonprofits most of the time. They're part of organizations that are begging for government money, and depending on who's in charge, you know, that money fluctuates. It increases and decreases accordingly, right? There are peaks and valleys. And I think that politics has a huge influence on art. So sometimes I like to take some of the great speeches, like I did with Robert F. Kennedy or Charlie Chaplin's speech in the last episode, because I think it's relevant. I mean, and you have to keep in mind that the speech with Charlie Chaplin was a film, which is in the arts, right? And in this episode, we're talking about film and speech, which is like an oratorial art form, it's sort of literary, I guess. I mean, spoken poetry in a sense, except it's not structured. It's obviously different than a poem. But my point is that, you have to expect that these things are going to interact with each other and affect each other, because they do. Some of the things that really strike me about the speech is that, as I was mentioning before about this time period where all these people were getting assassinated, and by the way, if you've never seen the JFK footage of the assassination, it's fucking terrible. Oh my God, it's terrible. I mean, his poor wife sitting right next to him, it is just gross and disgusting. And it, you know, you gotta want, I mean, here's a guy who stands up and says, and I'll quote here, "We are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice. Its dissenters are silenced," he goes on to say. Now that is chilling. Now at the time, nobody thought about that, but you know, when you go back and listen to those speeches, it's interesting to think about what this guy may have been opposing that we still don't really know. I mean, some people claim to know, some really big conspiracy guys. And, you know, and I don't want to dismiss people who say, who get into conspiracies, because, first of all, a percentage of conspiracy theories are going to be true. Statistically, it's just going to happen. It's just a matter of finding out which ones. And what if it's the big ones? You know, who knows? And as he said in that speech, if we're not going to fix whatever we've allowed to happen, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to fix it. So that's what's going on there in the opening. Just a little light morsel for you to digest. Transitioning into this episode, which it's sort of a similar theme. It's more about technological takeover, if you will. Santos and I saw the movie Nerve, which was, you know, I wasn't sure what to expect from it. It's about a girl that gets sucked into a game where you become either a player or a watcher. And so you enter this game and people can dare you to do stunts, right? You can go and steal something. You can go up to somebody and talk to them at a bar, whatever it might be. And then people will throw money at you to try to, or contribute money to try to get you to do it. So, you know, you could get dared, right? And do you have the nerve to do it for, say, $200? And pretty soon it gets crazy, as it always does. It's sort of like Lord of the Flies, it's reminding me of, where you have this chaotic technological structure. Ooh, that's interesting, where there isn't any structure, so to speak. The politicians haven't caught up with the technological world. So we talked a lot about this versus other artificial intelligence movies like Her and maybe Ex Machina, I love all those films. But I think Nerve was interesting because it seemed more realistic, where you download an app and there isn't a leader. You know, even the people who programmed this in this movie, you know, they're just throwing it out there. It's the people who are making it go. And if they end up calling for people's death or murdering or whatever it is, you know, that's kind of on us. I mean, they're always going to be crazy people, right? Out of 1,000 people in any given space, how many of them are crazy? At least a couple. So times 1,000 by however many you need to get 350 million or 7 billion, clearly there's some fucked up people out there. And unfortunately, they all have internet access like everybody else. But you can't stop it. So what do? We thought this was a great topic to talk about. That's what we did. And remember, you can find out more about Santos at @tos_ram. That's TOS_RAM. Butter that toast, as he would say, I think. I'm not sure. Maybe I just made that up. So here it is, episode number 43 with Santos Ramos. Enjoy. Talking earlier about Nerve, the film Nerve, and you made the comparison to Her.
Yeah, I think that if people haven't seen Her, it's another film about like the future of technology that's based on this. It's based on AI or artificial intelligence, and it kind of is making the assumption, like a lot of these technological films, that we're somehow getting closer to AI. Which I don't necessarily agree with. Whereas this movie Nerve is more what I think of in terms of like where the relationship between humans and technology is headed. It's more closely connected to what especially young people are doing with technology. I don't know if you want to talk about the premise of Nerve at all.
Well, Nerve was really interesting because it was realistic. It's where there's a game and you sort of enter into it and you get dared to do certain stunts and you can get cash rewards. And there isn't a central location for the game. It's just sort of everybody's device acts as a server once they log in, if I understand that correctly. So what motivates people to do things are the cash rewards that are donated anonymously. But anonymous people called watchers also get to pick the dare. And there are repercussions, of course, if you try to back out. Since they're tech savvy, they can wipe your bank account or, sort of hold you e-hostage in a way. So people in this film have to perform these stunts once they've entered into it. And of course, like Pokemon Go or any other game, people do enter into it because they're fascinated with it. And I think this movie was very realistic, in a not necessarily in a futuristic sense, but in a now sense, that these kind of things are already happening, especially if you talk about Pokemon Go, which I just mentioned.
Yeah, as a movie, I would say that Nerve it's not great. It's watchable. It's definitely watchable. It was entertaining. I'm glad that I saw it. I probably wouldn't rewatch it. But just in terms of like the commentary that it's making on technology, even though it was not the best movie and was sort of dumbed down, like it really tried to explain things to the audience like we're stupid. Despite all those things, like I think its actual commentary on technology was more insightful than movies like Her. What's that other one with?
Ex Machina.
Yeah, is that the one with Poe from... Yeah. The evil character is Poe from Star Wars, that guy's name? I don't know the actor's name, but... But yeah, movies like that, which are probably seen as more intellectual because of how they're shot, because of the story or whatever else, they're a little bit more artsy, so they're seen as smarter, but to me, a lot of those are kind of based... I think I've said this on the podcast before, but movies like Her and Ex Machina feel like two-hour-long Apple commercials to me about like where technology is headed, whereas Nerve, even though it was pretty cheesy and watered down, offered a different perspective on technology that actually reflects the way that people are using technology in terms of the games and aspects of like the way that these alternate realities that we're creating actually bypass certain societal structures that we've set up. So there's like several references to like anarchy and things like that, which I don't think is really touched in some of those other artsy kind of technologically oriented films.
No, and I can't remember Ex Machina that well, but I don't remember in Her there being any sort of a rebellion, whereas in Nerve, there does feel like there's somewhat of a rebellion at the end when they sort of appeal to the human element. Well, I say human, but humans also caused the problem in the first place. The more compassionate side of humanity by getting them to end the nonsense that was occurring. I mean, the Dares, as you can imagine, if you haven't seen the film, were getting out of control, as they always do. And since, especially when things are anonymous, you've got people forcing other people to do all kinds of crazy shit. I think it's not only a more realistic view, but I think it's also something that if you're going to make a piece of art and you want to make a comment on it that you think is important, that you want to reach people, this is the kind of film, even if it's not done as, say, artistically or aesthetically challenging, or there's all kinds of visuals that are done at what you might think are an interesting or unique perspective, you are going to reach more people with a film like this, I think, because even though it's there are parts of it that are dumbed down for audiences that might fall into that category, it probably is a film that would reach more people than, say, a Her or an Ex Machina.
Yeah, definitely. I just wish there was something kind of in between that was able to reach lots of people, but wasn't, doing some of the things that those other films do. Because I don't think they didn't need to dumb it down. It's like the film was obviously, the audience that was in mind was like a very young audience. And so it felt like to me that the creators felt as though they needed to dumb it down because their audience was going to be younger. But, I just didn't think that was the case. Like we talked about how at the end of the film there's a little speech that the main character gives, and it's just sort of out of place because the whole film had been about, I can't remember what she was talking about. That's when she brought in the anonymous dynamics, and she was just basically explaining the entire film to the, whoever's watching, and it was totally unnecessary because that's what the entire film was about. So there were all these kinds of moments where they dumbed it down when it wasn't necessary at all, I don't think.
No, and that speech was something that should have been cut out, because after there was a lot of drama, it was moving fast, and then at the end she's kind of just like, come on guys, computers, man, am I right? You know, like, we got it. We know what this film is about. It's about humans being able to deal or respond to the integration of technology into their lives, and are we doing it well or are we not? It's interesting that this film is also something that touched a little bit on it. Like you said, it was marketed towards a younger audience, whereas like Her and Ex Machina, maybe Transcendence with Johnny Depp, I don't know if you saw that, but he basically, before he died, uploaded his consciousness to the internet so that he could live on inside the computers on the other side. And those films seem to me to be more academic. So when you have things that are more academic, where Santos and I are on the road here, we're passing like some sort of John Deere spider that was passing us. It was a huge truck. We're on a country road here, trying to enjoy the peacefulness, and then we see these John Deere Ex Machina type machines coming at us that are, I don't even know if anybody was driving that. In the future, it'll just be, they'll be running themselves and running the farms computer style. But those, when you have a film that really challenges people intellectually or on anything, whatever the right word is to say there, it feels like that excludes a lot of the younger crowd, whereas this film felt the opposite of that. It was very millennial, and if it could have just not, I say millennial in the sense like the soundtrack was very youthful, and it moved at a pace that younger audiences might be might view as normal, whereas I could sit there and watch one shot of It's Beautiful last for 30-40 seconds. And I'm not saying that Her or Ex Machina or Transcendence do that, but like you said, there's in between there, I think you could reach for, that might appeal to everybody, and where you could sort of go further with it.
Yeah, and I'm interested in that assumption about artificial intelligence, that, because that's what all those, to me, that narrative keeps getting told over and over again. But to me, that's a really, and it's just taken for granted, but to me, that's a really interesting and also kind of problematic assumption to make, that just because we're building more powerful machines, that they're somehow coming closer to human consciousness.
It's tough to say. I mean, there are some scientists out there who think that a computer becoming sentient will happen. It's hard to conceive from this point. I don't know if they're onto something or not, but I definitely, I'm not sure at what point when does that point hit? Is it when it can make its own it's going to be basing everything off of everything we've told it, you know, ingesting our conversations and our search habits and how we talk to each other. So it's hard to know exactly when it becomes itself and when it was always just us, because we're sort of building it ourselves. It's just going to reflect the way we are.
Yeah, so what is that missing element? To me, if there's like some, I mean, essentially we're asking, what is consciousness, or what does it mean to be human? And that's why it's such an interesting topic to me. But so what is the missing element there? Is consciousness just being able to process a great amount of information? Because to me, how do you come close to that missing element without, how are we coming closer to it if all machines are being able to process more and more information? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, I think we do that. And in addition to that those tasks, though, I think one of the things that computers don't do is they don't seem to display emotion. They're sort of like Vulcans, if pardon that Star Trek reference there. I don't know anything about Star Trek. But I believe that Vulcans are very non-emotional beings. If I have that wrong, please let me know at Arthouse 43. But I don't know what that point is either. And we think that it's going to maybe be an us and them scenario, where we're using our computers and then the MacBook just sort of stands up and runs away, grows legs or whatever.
gets Amazon body parts delivered while you're at work, and then it stalls it itself and then runs away. But it's, I think it's just going to be some sort of a hybrid between us and them.
Well, that's what I liked about the movie Nerve, is that it was sort of like an inverse take on AI to those other kinds of films we keep referencing, in that it wasn't about artificial intelligence. It was about these alternative realities that we're creating, and it's about the convergence of our virtual and our physical realities, like becoming so entangled that, you know, they really do have material sort of consequences to them. Whereas, you know, Ex Machina, Her, other films, The Matrix, sort of come at it from the other direction. The Matrix might be in a different category than all of these films, though.
Yeah, it is. We do tend to think of the technology and where it's going and AI as being sort of a, we're all sitting here politely huddled around a fire, checking our phones, waiting for the moment when the computer sends us all a message and now I will kill you all. But really, this movie was probably the most realistic in which it was, we were just making the system, we were making this thing happen. It was us all along. It wasn't a robot, it wasn't a computer. It was, that was just the tool, the medium through which we could act out our shitty behaviors.
Yep.
There you have it. It does point to the idea that humans, whatever tools we create, are just going to reflect who we are anyway. Whether it's, if a computer can take things over, it certainly, in medicine and in communication, there are obviously benefits to it. But whatever percentage of humans that are shitty and do terrible things, that's it. I don't necessarily think it's going to increase, but it's going to be a problem when you have people to be being able to control drones and put anything they want. They could terrorize people they don't even know and just fly around and drop, you know, terrible things on them that they create through their 3D printers. So, but it's still basically us. It's not the drones doing it itself.
Speaking of which, on our city, our little shitty city, Battle Creek, from their Facebook page, they recently just posted like some event that the police were throwing, some public event where they were like inviting people to come meet their bomb sniffing robot. Like, you could just, I don't know what to make of that, but it's just an interesting sort of event. Like, why would everybody want to come meet the robots that you're going to use to, like, I don't know, because it's fucking weird.
It's like the scene in Rocky IV when everybody meets Rocky's robot and it sings Happy Birthday, Uncle Polly. You know. Anyway, I just wanted to clear, Sonos is saying terrible things about BC, but I love it. We're all just kidding. It's all good fun, except for that robot. I wonder what its name is.
Probably has one. Jerry, I think they called it.
Come meet the thing that's gonna, you know, they did, it's there was some sort of incident where it was like a bomb, not a bomb robot, like that robot's so bomb, like some sort of device that they use to sniff out bombs or like grab suspicious packages, and it ended up killing somebody. They used one of those robots from, which is basically like a drone, but it was on the ground. So that is a strange thing to introduce a robot as a member of the police force. What happens if you assault that robot? Is it the same as assaulting a police officer?
Probably, but it reminds me of, you were telling me about some documentary you saw about the Unabomber. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it's on YouTube. It's in German with English subtitles, and I still need to research a lot of this, but it was really interesting because it talked about Ted Kaczynski. And if you don't remember Ted Kaczynski, he's the Unabomber. He was, I believe he was he participated, I don't know, I'm sure if it was willing or unwillingly, in a series of tests or experiments that were part of the MK Ultra thing in the 70s. And later on, he went to the University of Michigan and he was very anti-technology. And he started, this documentary alleges that he sent those bombs with the intent to kill people that were working in a scientific laboratory that were working on advanced AI studies and things like that. Whereas the the media portrayed it as he was sort of killing random people in the U.S. or around the world, but I believe that it was most of them were postal workers who were delivering these packages that were supposed to explode. Not saying it's a good thing, but I mean, this documentary talks a lot about that. About most people think the Unabomber was just some sort of freak, crazy guy who was sending out packages, but it had something to do with technology.
And you said that he had been part of an experiment or something. He was experimented on.
He was allegedly part of the MK Ultra experiments, which were essentially brainwashing experiments into brainwashing or controlling people through mind control or things like that. Which I know if you're not a big conspiracy person, or you don't have to be to believe in mind control. It's not like, you know, tinfoil hat things. I mean, Doritos commercials are attempts at mind control. They want you to buy their products. It's if you say the word mind control or brainwashing, it sounds like for people who followed a cult leader down to, you know, South America and like did terrible things and finally they snapped out of it. But I mean, Carl's Jr., those commercials are attempts at brain control. That, why else would they pay, you know, how many millions of dollars for 20 seconds of a Super Bowl ad if they didn't work?
Yeah. And so, I mean, we haven't done the research on this documentary or whatever, but I think regardless of whether or not these details are true, it still brings up some interesting points about the reason I was so fascinated when you told me that was that it's so reflective of the way that any kind of, when any killing happens, which there have been a lot in recent history, we just sort of dismiss people as being crazy without truly reflecting on how we as a society collaborated on creating, like, even if they are crazy, we still, in a sense, produced that person. Like, our society produced a person like that. Like, through those experiences, whether he was, you know, experimented on or not. But we just have a tendency to dismiss whoever's in those positions. Like, I think Dave Chappelle had a quote that, like, he was saying the worst thing you can call somebody is crazy because it's totally dismissive and it just, you're just absolving yourself of having to understand that person's experience and your own culpability in their experience. By calling somebody crazy.
And that happened to him when you know he took off to Africa, or supposedly, and then, you know, people said, well, he turned down $100 million from Comedy Central. He must be crazy.
Yeah, that's exactly. It was like one of his first interviews after that. I think he was on Oprah or something, and yeah.
And not only in the same sort of area there, you'd call somebody conspiracy theorist and they're instantly dismissed as being, you know, sitting around with a telescope looking for aliens every night, when really, I mean, if you had said that, I can't think of an example, but if you had said that the government or somebody was working on a computer that could send messages from Michigan all the way out to China, if you told somebody that in the 1960s, they probably would have laughed at you and said, like, why would... Yeah, you're crazy. Like, you know, basically describing the internet. But they were using, like, submarines were communicating in sort of weird ways from long distances back in that time period. But if you had suggested that that was in the works or it was happening, you know, you would have been considered a kook. There are better examples than that. But the point is that if even 20% of the conspiracy theories out there are true, it makes zero sense to have that term conspiracy theorist or crazy have so much clout when you talk about throwing it on someone, because it dismisses their argument entirely when really you might be able to gain something from it by likely 10-20% of it's going to be true.
Yeah, I think it's sort of, and maybe it's just oversimplification, that term conspiracy theorist. Sometimes it's kind of hard to name. I'm thinking of people who have different, like, kind of wacky political theories who I would actually probably consider to be conspiracy theorists, but at the same time, like, what does that really mean? They could say the same thing about me just because they disagree with, you know, my analysis of what's happening in the world and how power functions in the world.
It's kind of a lazy way to go about things, because if you call somebody crazy or they're a conspiracy theorist, it's a lazy way to just brush them aside, and you do it, you do so in a manner that probably ruins their credibility in a larger sense for ever, maybe, but really, rather than taking apart. Now, if somebody just constantly talks about how lizards are in the White House and, you know, there are raccoons running the markets, like, that's obviously, that's at a certain point you have to think, like, this person's a little bit a couple of pickles short of a pickle factory. I can't think of a better I couldn't think of what goes on pickles.
You're crazy. But yeah, I think that's just, might be better to just say that they're wrong. Like, calling somebody a conspiracy theorist is like calling somebody just crazy. You know, it's totally, where the more accurate thing is just to say, you know, whatever you're saying, it's wrong. You're not connecting the dots in a correct way, which is different from saying, you know, your experience is totally invalid and you're not, nothing about what you're saying is true.
Almost all of history up to this point has sort of been the honor system. I mean, you've got how many records that you can read about different civilizations that are basically handwritten. I mean, when did photography come into play? In the mid 1800s, maybe? Everything else is sort of based on witness testimony, and who knows what's true and what's not. I mean, we sort of gauge what we think happened. It becomes a never-ending thing if you say, well, I wasn't there, so it must not have happened. The Holocaust didn't happen because I wasn't there. I didn't see it, you know. But nowadays we have everything happening through video and Photoshop. It's really hard to tell what's happening, what percentage of things that are happening are fact or actually taking place.
Yeah, and... Oh, shit.
We're here in Charlotte, Michigan. We're near the Tasty Twist here as we talk about conspiracy theories. I'm sure there was somebody said that Tasty Twist didn't exist, but it does. We just drove by it. We've also got a road closure here as we turn around in the HGB Urgent Care. I know you're interested in this because you follow this podcast, and sometimes things get off course a little bit. We are not going to urgent care. We are right in here. Everything's fine. As people look at us in the mirror, we might be a little mentally unstable, but nothing physical happening yet. We'll try to find our way out of here. Conspiracy Theories 101 with Santos and Troy. Write in some of your favorite conspiracy theories here at Art House 43. I'm not going to say at Spanish Peanuts anymore because that one's pretty much... I still use it, but I think it's in order to keep the brand of Art House going. I've switched to Art House 43, and actually I have several hundred followers now. So those of you out there who have clicked follow on there, I thank you very much. You should tweet at me and let me know your favorite conspiracy theories and how they... especially if they relate to technology and aliens and the like. I mean, you can feel free to do political ones, but this isn't really a political podcast. But I'd be more than happy to read some of them on air. If you want to make up a few of them, why not? Who cares?
I was watching... I used to be into alien conspiracy theories. I mean, I thought that there might be some truth to some of them, but mostly, like, just because I thought they were entertaining. And the most entertaining aspect is that people believe, or at least seem to truly believe, some of the shit that they're saying. Like, I was watching these YouTube videos of a guy who was explaining the history of the universe in great detail, all these different races of aliens that he knew all about somehow. And he was talking about how the moon got pulled into anchor by a giant ship. Just like speaking with, you know, like he knew exactly what he was talking about. Like, of course, very matter-of-factly, like, just about all these, like, where did you even hear this shit, dude?
It's interesting when people are so convinced by their own things that it makes you start to question your own sanity. Like, of course a tractor trailer pulled the moon closer to the Earth. What's wrong with you? It's a space tractor trailer. Obviously, it can move through, you know, zero gravity spaces, but it's... Well, I mean, how else would it have gotten there?
You can add some crickets in there.
Yeah, crickets. There'll be a lot of crickets in this episode, I think. That's aliens. Topic two, aliens. What should we do with these aliens?
Take two.
Those aliens, they sure are funny.
And from someplace else.
Yeah, I don't know if you've watched Stranger Things on Netflix yet, but
I haven't
finished it. I'm about halfway through, maybe, and I'm not sure if aliens are gonna come into play here. Speaking of aliens, the X-Files, pretty cool. Just like,
did we do a post X-Files episode at one point?
We did, but I don't remember if we. I remember doing an episode on the X-Files, but I don't remember if we had a discussion about it or not.
I only watched the first of the new ones, but I was kind of bored and disappointed.
Interesting. I thought they were pretty good. There were two episodes. I think they released six, and there were two episodes that were didn't really have anything to do with the overall story. Maybe one or two, but I thought overall it was pretty good. I mean, I don't know if they're going to make more. I would imagine yes, since it was overwhelmingly popular.
I just remember that it got very, like, Alex Jonesy. Like, it was all about the New World Order or something, the first episode.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if it, which side, I'm not sure if it was the sort of thing where they were from going from that perspective or they were questioning that perspective. I have to go back and rewatch them, to be honest. But the first go I have at things is never usually my best I don't give my best analysis after just one viewing of anything, usually.
Yeah, it takes a while with Radiohead albums. Sometimes with Louis C.K. TV episodes.
Yeah, both of those things are hard to see at first. I saw Zoolander the first time in a theater, and I basically wanted to walk out.
I think I did the same thing with that and with Napoleon Dynamite, because I think Napoleon Dynamite was like the first in a new wave of sort of comedies that didn't exactly tell you when to laugh. I think that's why that was. And Zoolander is usually pretty obvious, but
it's hard to get into Zoolander, or it was hard because it's so dumb that it becomes the point of the comedy, that it's so dumb, and it's I don't know, it's good for shutting off your brain kind of thing, but I'm not sure if it's sort of like abstract or non-representational painting or photography. Like, I can tell you what I like, but I'm not sure why or why not. Here we are back on North 69 here, headed up to Lansing, Michigan. That's the area that this podcast is made in, and if that's okay with you, that's okay with us. Got a light westerly breeze coming out of the southwest here at 73 degrees. We're about 90 degrees here in Michigan. It's July 29th, 2016. We are on the road. We have seen the film Nerve today, and we are talking about it after we enjoyed some Mexican food at La Cocina on Columbia Avenue. Maybe you've been there, maybe you haven't. Nerve, the film about kids and their phones and their silly little games. Millennials, what a kooky bunch, eh?
Talk about how the food at Mexican restaurants comes out way too quickly.
it's like they're using predictive technology back there. Like, as soon as we walk in, they scan our phones and see what we order, and they already start cooking it up.
Yeah, it almost comes... there's a Mexican food truck by our house. It almost... is like faster at the restaurant than the food truck even.
Yeah, it comes out alarmingly fast, and in a lot of ways I think Mexican food in restaurants is generally good, but it has sort of it feels like it could be so much healthier than it is. There's a lot of fried portions of things and lots of unhealthy government cheese sort of shenanigans going on. I feel like most Mexican restaurants are sort of playing to what they think Americans want, or maybe Americans do want that, but it seems like you could make it so much fresher and healthier if you wanted to.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's a really good book called Decolonize Your Diet that's all plant-based, what they call traditional Mexican recipes. So it happens to be vegetarian. The point of the book isn't really not to cook with meat, but it's more just kind of things that you're talking about. There's less frying, there's less oil, there's less cheese. They don't really use a whole lot of cheese and things like that. But I think that, yeah, part of it has to do with just, you know, being on the market. Anytime you go out to eat, most places are going to be more unhealthy than it would be if you cooked at home and you got to make decisions about how much salt and how much oil to use and things like that. Because Mexican food is traditionally very, very healthy, but, you know, when you go out to eat, it's going to be all the fatty, unhealthy stuff.
It doesn't make much sense to me because, like, if you look at the nutritional content on a Whopper, it's a Whopper. I mean, it's like 1,900 calories, I believe, something like that. That's like a day's worth of food, and just the Whopper, not counting the fries or anything. Or the strawberry shake, you're, of course, going to get, just like I do, because strawberry shakes are, that's the stuff right there.
I have to get one right now.
Yeah, sounds pretty good. Let's make a stop at Burger King for a strawberry shake as we do this. But if you think about a Whopper, there's not really anything on there. I mean, it's a bun, a burger, like there's some mayo and there's, you know, maybe some cheese, but there's no reason for that thing to be 1,900 calories. I mean, I can make a grilled burger for a fourth of that easily. So, I mean, some of it's probably coating it with some special kind of butter that was like fried in deep oil and fat that just makes you think that it's the best thing ever. But I think it would taste just fine without it.
I mean, especially if you talk about places like McDonald's and huge places like that, they've done so much scientific research to get every economic advantage out of that food that they can. And I don't know what kind of scientific or technology is behind this, but like, I feel like sometimes even if you have gone to like a fast food restaurant and eaten a shit ton of food because you're really hungry, and it seems like you should be full, but you're not. I feel like they did some, like there's something about it where like even chemically they could like, you know, convince your brain that it hasn't consumed that much so that you keep eating and so that you would buy more.
There are probably like food conferences for restaurant entrepreneurs where you can go and they won't say it directly, but they'll give you tips on making people feel just what you described, not full, but you've eaten a ton of things, but you still have room to keep buying. And they'll say like, well, we found that if you give them a little more sugar in their drink, that they will order more food and they will not feel completely full, even though they just had like a 3-course meal.
Yeah, I remember this is sort of an older book. I read it when I was at community college. It's called Fast Food Nation, and the author had done research at like the labs where a lot of these recipes are put together at fast food joints. And at one point, he was blindfolded in one of these labs, and they were holding up things for him to smell. And so he, for example, remember he was blindfolded and he said that he could smell just like a Whopper or whatever. And he, you know, it was a very familiar smell. There was no doubt in his mind that what they were holding up was a Whopper, but then they would take the blindfold off and it was actually just like a little like plastic strip that they were holding up with, you know, whatever fucking chemicals they put in there to get it to smell a particular way. That's one of the parts of the book that just really stood out to me, that like even the way that some of the shit smells is like chemically engineered.
That's crazy. I don't know if this was true or not, but we've seen a few stories over the last few years about people who have taken McDonald's burgers, or they just happened to have them in a bag in their back seat and they were there for a couple of years and there was no degradation at all in the product. It was still the way it looked when they got it that day. That's, on the one hand, that's really scary, and on a slightly smaller hand, a scarily smaller hand, I wonder if you could make the argument, like, listen, we don't have enough food for everyone, so we have to try to grow stuff smartly through engineering, food science, and our different products in a way that we can control. I don't know how much validity there is to that argument, but it still seems awfully terrible to go down that road.
Well, that's not what it's being used for. You know, it's made that way either as just an incidental sort of freakish science like coincidence, or for economic, very like calculated economic purposes, like they would want their food to last, so they're made in that way. But yeah, that's totally scary that it wouldn't even like begin to decompose.
All of this stuff we've been talking about comes back to the same question, I think. We started out talking about nerve and the role that technology plays in our lives, and are we being responsible with it? If we are or we aren't, will that continue into the future? And now we're talking about food, and everybody goes to the store or everybody goes to a place to eat, and they make that choice a couple times a day to eat food that they know where it came from, or it's got a million ingredients on it, and now they're at the mercy of these companies that are engaging in food construction or food manipulation, whatever you want to call it. And it comes back to the question of, are we active enough in our own lives to make these things better, which in turn makes the collective better?
Yeah, it just feels like we've become so disconnected in so many different ways. You know, we're disconnected from the processes of how our food gets made, how it gets grown, from, you know, the way that seeds are modified, the way that the proliferation of particular seeds homogenizes food in general and kills, you know, there used to be a lot more like seed diversity than there is now. We're disconnected from the way things are manufactured, so we don't think about them, all those different elements, when we're just buying something in the store. And I think that we're also even just disconnected from our bodies. Like, I've been noticing this about myself, especially recently, because I feel like I've become a lot more conscious over the last couple years of the kinds of food that I'm cooking and where they come from and all of that. And, you know, I'd listen to signs that my body tells me that I didn't used to listen to. Like, now I know that if I eat a particularly shitty meal, my body can already sort of feel like the impact that that's going to have. I'm like, well, if I eat this shitty meal, my day's pretty much done. I'm just going to lay around, and I'm not going to have the energy to do the things that I want to do or need to do. I'm going to have a different perspective on life.
It's going to affect your, like, I hate to use the word productivity, but like in your own life, productivity. If I wake up and I have a really green salad, I have some avocado with a little bit of oil, and then I have a smoothie, and then maybe I have some fresh vegetables on next to some rice and some beans and some tofu, or you know, maybe a kale salad or something like that. I feel great. I feel fantastic. I feel like my body and my brain are getting all the things it needs. You know, homemade kombucha. I feel like I'm on top of my game. Whereas if I have a shitty, greasy meal, like, all I do is think about, why did I eat that? I feel terrible.
Yeah, I think we can talk about it in terms of productivity, but I think it also sounds like what you're talking about is just quality. Like, the quality of how you're feeling, your perspective on life. I'm like literally happier when I eat particular kinds of food. Since I started eating more and cooking with more chili peppers, different kinds of chili peppers and cactus, totally changed just like my perspective on my mood, even my emotional well-being. So I don't know, I just feel like for so long I was just sort of disconnected, because, you know, especially when I was younger, because I worked out so much because I was involved with sports, that I could eat pretty much whatever I wanted and like my body wouldn't change, you know. So I was just eating pizza all the time just because that's what was around. And, you know, I just got used to not listening closely to how my body would respond to food, because I was always trapped in that basically pizza state of mind, like, oh, I'm supposed to be tired after I eat a meal, or I'm supposed to, you know, feel groggy or, you know, be a certain way. Whereas now, if I'm making a lot of fresh food, eating a lot of like cactus and, you know, locally grown tomatoes and onions and stuff, I don't have that same reaction.
There's some sort of connection between technology and food, and I'm not sure what it is and whether it's a bad thing or a good thing, but you would think that with the invention of technology that our lives would have been better, including in the food regard, because you know, we can do things with our phones that a lot of people obviously, they haven't had these devices in history, previous to, at least we don't think so. So you know, you think you'd be able to like construct some sort of a communication between yourselves and ourselves and say the places where we shop. So like you, if you want to go to Meijer or Fred Meijer or Winn-Dixie or wherever you are, Publix, wherever you are in the country, you can sort of, you go into those places and sometimes they don't have the best vegetables. They're not organic. They're not local. But if you could communicate with them through the devices that we're using and contribute to, you know, like making requests and all that. And I'm sure you can, but it seems like we don't have more free time to make food because of these devices. We have less time, and I'm not sure how that works. It should be the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, that's the paradox of technology too, is that we're constantly being told that technology is going to make our lives easier, but that's true in the short term because, you know, they're helping us cut corners in all of these different ways, but in the long run, I think there's pretty much consensus around the fact that the world moves a lot faster than it used to. So that's such a like contradictory, those are like two very contradicting concepts. So I just don't really understand why we can't step back and look at it that way.
And you can't shut it off. That's the big thing.
Yeah.
So one of the things that, for me, the integration between technology and food that works is if I know that I'm going to spend an hour making some sort of healthy dish with beans and vegetables and you know, rice or whatever it is, I will use my device to pump out some podcasts while I'm doing it. My favorite podcast, like Art House Radio, or maybe some other ones, but really just Art House Radio. No, but doing that while I cook, and it takes me an hour to prepare because I move slow anyway. But that to me, it makes me feel more at ease. Like I feel like I'm using technology in the appropriate and the smart way, because it's encouraging me. Like you don't feel like you're missing out on stuff here. You can participate in the world, or you know, have some sort of entertainment while you cook or prepare the meal. Not that I need it, but it's one thing. It's one possible solution, at least for myself. That comment left him speechless. We are on 496 headed downtown Lansing, folks, and I'll leave you with this. A while back, I saw a truck that was so dirty that somebody had written on it, you know, that classic gag, wash me and all that stuff. But this time, they had a very interesting group of words, maybe called sentences. I don't know what you call them. It said, liar Hillary and Trump asshole. 2016, welcome to America. Thanks for listening. Art House Radio is brought to you by people like you who go to our website, arthouse43.com, click on donate, and then make either a one-time or recurring donation. Creative projects are never free, so any support you could give would be very, 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 very much appreciated. Subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, all that stuff. Don't forget
to give us some reviews too. Well, I am your host, Troy Ramos. Thank you for listening to episode 43. Episode 44, of course, is up next, and that should be interesting. You know, we're getting through this, right? We're, you know, last season we had about 34 episodes, and it'll probably be about the same this time. So we're not quite a third of the way done with the season. And of course, if I can land some sponsors or the donations come rolling in, maybe I'll extend it. Maybe we'll see. Money talks, as AC/DC said once. I believe in the Brian Johnson years. Money talks. I'm not going to sing it for you. I could, but I'm not going to. So, enjoy the space between this episode 43 and the next time we interact. I wish you well. Be peaceful. Be happy that you're alive. We're all alive. We're winning. Okay? That's the key. Don't let anybody tell you anything else. You don't have a new car. Bills got you down. Relationship stuff, friends, whatever. You're alive and you're winning. All right? Enjoy it, my friends. Until next time.